from their nest in a desperate attempt to cool off. Aquatic species haven't been spared either. Fish that evolved over thousands of years to survive in cool waters have died in staggering numbers in recent years, blanketing the surfaces of U.S. rivers. And it's not just the heat that threatens fish like Pacific salmon and many others. Glaciers that ensure a steady flow of cold water throughout the summer are rapidly disappearing. This summer's scorching temperatures will bring more of the same for animals across the country. The grim reality is these events will become more common because the U.S., among others, has refused to meaningfully address climate change. The planet's amazing biodiversity is threatened as plants and animals struggle to adapt to conditions they're not built for. If Americans don't change course, the result will be more of what they have already experienced. Extinction at a rate the world hasn't seen in at least 66 million years. In the Pacific Northwest, climate change-induced heat is pushing the general mid-rainer white-tailed ptarmigan to the brink. These shy alpine birds live in meadows nestled high in the Cascades from British Columbia to Mount Adams. In the winter, they bury themselves under dry, fluffy snow to keep warm. But climate change is making this type of snow rarer, replaced instead by snow with tough crust. In the summer, these birds prefer wet areas created by melting snowfields and glaciers, which are rapidly disappearing. Temperatures above 70 degrees Fahrenheit stress these birds, but these temperatures are becoming more common even above the tree line where the grouse live. Stress from heat compounds other factors like drought, disease, and habitat destruction that make it harder for plants and animals to survive. The Center for Biological Diversity has petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to protect the mid-rainer white-tailed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, leading to proposed protection of the little grouse. Many other alpine adapted species, from adorable American pikas to wolverines to moose, are similarly suffering as the planet warms. Already going extinct at a rate five times greater than land-dwelling species, it's freshwater species that may have the most to lose as heat waves magnify. During last summer's heat wave in the Pacific Northwest, shellfish died in unprecedented numbers. In the Southeast, home to an astonishing 91% of the unique and irreplaceable freshwater mussel species found across the United States, mussels and other aquatic plants and animals are highly vulnerable to the extreme temperatures they are experiencing. For decades, the science has clearly told Americans that they need to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. They also need to protect more of the natural world, particularly carbon-absorbing forests, which incidentally is the same thing they need to do to address another grave threat to animals and their way of life, the extinction crisis. The only question is whether politicians are brave enough to meet this moment with bold, urgent action. In the face of climate cowardice by legislators like Senator Joe Manchin, President Biden must take bold action to to address the climate crisis and reduce filthy fossil fuel emissions. The stakes, like the excruciating heat Americans are experiencing, will only get higher. Palestine Declassified.
Welcome to another episode of Palestine Declassified, where we examine the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm Chris Williamson, and I'm the host for today's show. In this week's programme, we're looking at an obscure British-based organisation that's active in conflict zones from Palestine to Ireland and beyond. We'll be delving into its background and ask, what is it really up to? As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, Bianca Rahimi has this report about a seemingly innocent group known as Forward Thinking, which claims to sponsor dialogue on issues of conflict.
Is Israel outsourcing its normalisation drive among Muslims to a well-known conflict resolution front for British intelligence? Forward Thinking is an organisation which explicitly seeks to normalise Israel within the Middle East and among the Muslim community elsewhere. Here, the founder of Forward Thinking and veteran NATO employee Oliver McTernan explains the origins of the organisation being a NATO conference where the following happens.
In that group, there were a number of Arab scholars from the Middle East and a handful of Israelis, including the commandant of the IDF law school, Amos Giora. And it was at the end of the 3-4 days, Amos said to us, you can't leave this just as a conference. We've got to see how it can be taken forward. And it was that sparked the idea of Forward Thinking, and an invitation came then from him to come to Israel-Palestine to meet key people and to see what could be done.
Of course, Amos Giora was the highest legal opinion in the Israeli military and was tasked with constructing legal arguments to justify the bombing of civilian sites like schools in Gaza. The roots of Forward Thinking can also be found in another long-time NATO employee and reserve in the British Army Intelligence Corps, Chris Donnelly's trip to the Hutzlia Security Conference in the apartheid entity. The future director of Forward Thinking attended this key Israeli military and intelligence conference in 2007 alongside a colleague of his and McTernan, Daniel Lafaidni. Both Donnelly and McTernan also shared positions on the Institute for Statecraft with Lafaidni. However, at the Hitzlia conference, Lafaidni stated his organisational home as BICOM, Britain's largest Israel lobby group. Forward Thinking's own trustees report states that it worked closely with Likud during the Netanyahu government to bring the previously pro-Palestinian Sinn Féin to the table of normalization with Israel. It was a long process of subverting Sinn Féin and defanging their pro-Palestinian stance. This engagement with the Israeli regime is something Forward Thinking openly take credit for bringing about. Oliver McTernan can be seen here at the Israeli government-funded Menachem Begin Heritage Center celebrating the normalization of relations between Egypt and Israel, alongside senior figures across the Israeli political spectrum. Menachem Begin was the head of the Zionist terror organization Ergun, which bombed the King David Hotel, killing 91 people, many of them British administrators. Forward Thinking proudly describes the terrorist Begin as having a legacy of making peace. Other posts on the Forward Thinking website describe influential Israelis helping develop our programs and show Oliver McTernan in the Knesset securing feedback on recent activities. Muslim organizations, political figures, and leaders must be under no illusion. Forward Thinking and Oliver McTernan work for Israel.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David co-founded and is a co-director of Spinwatch, the lobbying watchdog. We're also joined by Mohammed Almazi. Mohammed is a freelance journalist and he studied law at SOAS in London. He's contributed to numerous media outlets, including Jacobin, The Canary, Open Democracy and The Grey Zone. He's also written extensively about the attempt to extradite Julian Assange to the US and has covered all of the extradition hearings. Welcome to the show. Now, David, let me get this straight. Is forward thinking working for British and Israeli intelligence simultaneously?
Well, it's been set up by people who have military intelligence, British military intelligence connections, and it was set up at the behest of someone from the IDF. So it appears to be taking forward interests which are shared between British military intelligence and the Israeli state. But that's not entirely unusual. I mean, there are many organizations in this country which are engaged in counter-terrorism type activity, counter-extremism type activity, funded by the British government, but which are actually Zionist organizations. So it's not unusual for that to be the case, but it is unusual to find British military intelligence directly running an organization which appears to have this direct connection to Israel. That's slightly unusual, but the overall ideological confluence is not unusual.
Mm. And Mohammed, what can you tell us about this Chris Donnelly character?
Chris Donnelly, a member of SGMI, that specialist group military intelligence, a former advisor to NATO who focused on the Soviet Union. He, at least at the time, or SGMI is based in Hermitage Barracks in Denison. Denison Barracks in Hermitage. Right next to where the 77th Brigade is based. And the 77th Brigade are a military PSYOP unit. I mean, people can go and read about it in articles in, I think, the BBC, Wired magazine.
It's a British military
propaganda and PSYOP unit,
yeah.
Which itself is an amalgamation of previous units that
sure.
then came together.
Yeah.
And Donnelly is also a founder of numerous organizations, which we have since discovered are funded in part or in whole by the Home Office, the Foreign Office, NATO, and other institutions like the Smith Richardson Foundation, which is a neoconservative market fundamentalist institute.
Mm-hmm.
And these groups include, or the organizations that he's co-founded include, the Institute for Statecraft and one of their projects, the Integrity Initiative, ironically
yeah.
named Integrity Initiative, which well, is also a PSYOP group.
We'll touch on those organizations in a little bit more detail later. But David, Oliver McTernan and Forward Thinking, they seem to have quite a wide access, don't they, to pro-resistance factions. I mean, what do you think about this kind of interaction? I mean, is it valid? I mean,
well, so it comes out of this sort of idea that that peace processes are things which bring together formerly warring partners and resolve conflict and move on to a nice, peaceful future. And they look back to the South African process or the process in the north of Ireland, and they say their argument is, well, we have to have dialogue to bring the warring partners together to resolve the conflict in order for there to be peace.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, what is really happening with an organization like this is that they are penetrating resistance factions, like including Hamas. They're engaged with Hamas and with other Palestinian resistance factions and in other conflicts too, and they're bringing them towards some kind of negotiation with their sworn enemies, and in fact towards a normalization process,
mm-hmm.
to normalize the existence of the State of Israel and of Zionism as an occupation force in Palestine. So it's a means to defang and to remove the sting from the resistance. And it's not presented as that, of course,
yeah.
and there, sometimes the resistance factions who engage in this discussion and dialogue aren't aware that that's the case. Sometimes they will be aware and they'll have their own reasons for doing it, but it certainly isn't some kind of neutral, let's all link pinks and be friends together dialogue process. It's about undermining the resistance and bringing them to effectively defeat.
Hmm. And a bit closer to home, I mean, just tell us a little bit about Forward Thinking's normalisation process in Ireland.
So they've done a similar thing in Ireland. Now, of course, people will have different views, I guess, on the peace process in Ireland, but, you know, Sinn Féin has, over the decades, been a very steadfast ally of the Palestinians. You know, I go to Ireland regularly, and you know, you can still see flying over the bogside in Derry the Palestinian flag. And if you go to the Unionist villages round and about Derry, they have the Israeli flag flying, along with various loyalist paramilitary and terrorist group flags. So there's a very strong connection between the Irish Republican movement and the Palestinian Liberation Movement. They see themselves as being brothers in arms. And the forward-thinking involvement has tried to draw Sinn Féin into a dialogue with Likud and to try and bring them to some kind of dialogue with Likud, which is effectively a breach of the boycott and a normalization process. Now, there's been a big controversy about this in Sinn Féin and indeed in Irish Palestine Solidarity organizations where there's been a fight over it. And the people in Sinn Féin have been divided over it. But it does look like some factions of Sinn Féin have gone along with this. And it's a very sad day for Irish Palestine Solidarity work for that to be the case.
It's quite surprising, that to say the least. But, Mohammed, does it surprise you that there is this kind of crossover between British and Israeli intelligence in this way? I mean, what's your thoughts about that?
Not necessarily. I mean, if one looks at the history of relations in this region, normalization, that is to say, the push by Britain and the United States in particular, but not only, to get other states and groups and individuals to normalize relations with Israel without preconditions, so without Israel having to dismantle its illegal colonies, settlements, or bring an end to the apartheid system, has been a very long-term project. In fact, there are massive shifts in it. Recently, since Trump came to power, we've seen the post-revolution government in Sudan opening up normalization of relations openly. We've also heard reports, and there have been some public reporting as well, about Saudi Arabia and other countries which currently don't recognize the state of Israel, primarily because of how it was founded and what it continues to do. So there isn't anything particularly new in the push. This is just perhaps the latest stage, because there are long periods of time where the push was going nowhere. We saw the same thing with apartheid South Africa, where pushes to normalize, for all countries to have normalized relations with apartheid South Africa, notwithstanding its existence as an apartheid state or its racialized discrimination against the indigenous population, the way the state of Israel does the same towards the Palestinians, the indigenous population of Palestine and of the state of Israel.
Indeed. And there's certain very clear parallels, isn't there, between, apartheid South Africa and, the discrimination that the Israeli regime is engaged in Palestine. But David, I mean, some might say, look, there's nothing wrong with, and on the face of it, there doesn't appear to be anything wrong with conflict resolution in Palestine, obviously. What do you say to people saying that you're slightly overdoing it?
Well, it's not a conflict. That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, there is an occupation, and the occupation has to end, and that will remove the conflict. We don't remove the conflict by defeating the Palestinians. We remove the conflict by removing the occupation. And there's no other way of seeing it. You don't have peace without justice, and the only way to justice is to decolonize the whole of occupied Palestine. So, this idea that there are two sides, or two tribes fighting over land, or two ethnic groups or competing nationalisms, this is all rubbish. This is about Israeli colonialism, settled colonialism, which settled the land of Palestine and expelled the natives. Everybody knows this, but they try and deny it sometimes. Everybody knows this is a settler colony, just as a settler colony existed in South Africa, and indeed in the north of Ireland. And the root of the conflict in Northern Ireland, just the same as the root of the conflict in Palestine, it's settler colonialism, and you only end it by removing the settlers.
I mean, when you say, of course, everybody knows this, I mean, the truth is that, when you actually make that argument, very often, as you well know, and I've been a victim of this as well, have been subjected to accusations of anti-Semitism, haven't we? But anyway, we'll have to leave it there for a moment, because I just want to look at this report now on the Institute for Statecraft, a shadowy think tank that's connected to Forward Thinking.
Forward Thinking is clearly a British intelligence operation in the service of Israeli normalization objectives. Another organization which features several of the same figures is also suspected to be a push by British intelligence in a war of the minds. The Institute for Statecraft describes itself as a pro-democracy think tank. However, closer examination reveals it to be an insinuation of British intelligence dabbling in all manner of psychological warfare against both local and global targets. It's funded by the UK Ministry of Defence, NATO, the US State Department, and Facebook. The Institute for Statecraft has shared directors with handmaidens of the Israeli regime, Forward Thinking, Oliver McTiernan is simultaneously a director of the Institute for Statecraft and Forward Thinking. Chris Donnelly was also previously a director of both organizations at the same time. Daniel Lefeedni of Israel lobby group BICOM was also a key figure of the board of the Institute for Statecraft. Our host at Palestine Declassified, Chris Williamson, previously doorstepped the intelligence operation, coming face to face with Daniel Lefeedni. Whilst our shadowy protagonists seem allergic to sunlight, Forward Thinking and the Institute for Statecraft are clearly branches of the same tree. These shadowy figures of perception manipulation must be exposed.
David, I understand that Forward Thinking's been active in Tunisia, haven't they? I mean, what relevance do you think that has to the normalisation push in Tunisia?
Well, it's part of that process, isn't it? I mean, it appears from the work that they've done there and indeed other places that they're sort of involved in regime change and post-regime change activities. So they're trying to normalise in Tunisia, which would involve normalisation with the Zionist entity. And in a leaked report, a confidential report from Forward Thinking, which was leaked through the Integrity Initiative leak from the Institute for Statecraft in 2018, there's a report there which compares the normalisation process in Tunisia and the work they've been doing in Tunisia with the process which happened in Ukraine after the US-backed coup in 2014. So there's a real sense there that they're following the same kind of process which the West, in particular the US, but also the UK, were involved in Ukraine to try and change the Ukraine away from having any kind of relationship with Russia, which of course has led to the current conflict that there is in Ukraine. So this is a part of a sort of US State Department military intelligence, MI6 operation to move countries like Tunisia away from criticism of Israel, and in the case of Ukraine, to move Ukraine closer to the NATO orbit, which of course has had the disastrous consequences that we've seen in the last few months with the conflict in Ukraine.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we've just seen, haven't we, Mohammed, in that piece there about the Institute for Statecraft, which is clearly a sister organisation to the Forward Thinking. Tell us a little bit about your investigations into the Institute, and particularly in relation to the Integrity Initiative.
Okay, so in 2018, a group calling itself Anonymous Europe hacked and published in stages documents belonging to the Institute of Statecraft and the Integrity Initiative, which is a project of the Institute for Statecraft. They include emails, but also reports. And basically, a review of the document showed, among other things, that this this group and this organization, which is co-founded by Chris Donnelly and Dan Lefeedni. Mm-hmm. Dan Lefeedni is a former SAS, a former member of British Special Forces, and they're also involved in other organizations, as we've heard, but including the Active Change Foundation, which targets children in deprived communities, especially minority groups, instilling a military ethos in British society is something they very much believe in. They've written articles and reports saying as much. And the Integrity Initiative is on a rather sophisticated version, evidence of a sophisticated version of what Russia was accused of doing in the United States but never proven of doing during the elections, two presidential elections ago when Trump was won. So they have these clusters in various countries, that's what they call them, a network of networks, and each cluster has academics, politicians, military, ex or current members of the national security state apparatus in those respective countries. And the idea is that they internally work to push a concerted sort of objective, a certain perspective, but publicly, everyday members of the public are not meant to know that they're working together. Right, so there's nothing wrong with having an objective and trying to convince people of it, but this is a state-funded, Foreign Office-funded, NATO-funded outfit with journalists and others who are working together to push certain narratives or propagandize, basically, their respective societies. The tagline for the Integrity Initiative is defending democracy against disinformation. Mm. And while targeting Russian real or alleged disinformation seems to be part of it, another big part of it is about reshaping how people in the British and other public perceive the state of the world. I mean, that's evidenced by a report, internal report from Chris Donnelly, who argued that once upon a time, Only one third of British state funds were dedicated towards housing and health and social services. And they would like to convince, overtly or covertly, the British public to go back to that, because they complain now that two-thirds of spending are on health and social security and welfare issues, and not enough is spent on the military. Mm. And they want to invert that. They want to go back to what they consider to be a wartime mentality.
Well, they seem to be having some influence over the current British government in terms of where their priorities are currently lie. But, David, thinking about this crossover between British and Israeli intelligence, I mean, some people have suggested that my role in uncovering the shady activities of the Institute for Statecraft contributed to me being pushed out of Parliament. I mean, what do you think to that theory?
Well, you've always got to be very cautious in these areas, haven't you? When we're talking about the covert activities of intelligence agencies, which are by their nature secretive. And the information that we have about them comes in bits and pieces. We had the Integrity Initiative leaks. We've had more recently the Paul Mason leaks, where the former BBC journalist Paul Mason was in direct contact with this MI6 official who has been involved in a whole range of different covert propaganda operations and activities, including the Integrity Initiative back in 2018. So we don't have a full picture, but it's very clear that they have been targeting people like you and indeed me from the emails and the discussions. That they deliberately go after people like us. And of course, I was sacked partly as a result of a campaign by the Zionists, but it's also clear from the most recent Mason documents that there was a deliberate campaign to target me specifically and others who've been working with me. No doubt there's been similar campaigns against you, and you can spot sometimes the signs of that, but we don't have emails leaked as yet to show the full extent of any kind of campaign that might have been against you. But let's be clear about this. The Integrity Initiative was a project funded by the Foreign Office, directed by MI6, and run by military intelligence. They actually put an MI6, serving MI6 officer, inside the organization to oversee it, I always imagine, because MI6 couldn't trust military intelligence to get anything right, and quite right. But what happened to it was that there were complaints made. The organization was registered in Scotland to a derelict mill, and you went
and had
a look at the mill.
Yeah.
And of course, a complaint was put into the Scottish Charity Regulator, which is separate from the English Charity Commission, and is way less penetrated by neoconservative interests. And the Scottish Charity Regulator concluded that if you're working for MI6 or the Foreign Office, you can't call yourself a charity.
So they effectively
shut the whole project down. Yeah. And that was a really very clear victory for the campaigners doing that, including us. So no doubt that didn't go down very well with MI6.
Right, okay, yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now, as unfortunately we are completely out of time. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The population of monarch butterflies in North America has been falling rapidly in recent years, a decline largely unabated by government action to protect the imperiled insects or to fight the climate crisis that is pushing them to the brink of extinction. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading climate crisis pushes migratory monarch butterflies onto endangered list. Stay tuned for more. The International Union for Conservation of Nature formally listed the beloved migratory monarch butterfly as endangered, citing dire threats to the subspecies posed by the climate crisis, deforestation, pesticide use, and logging. Dr. Bruno Obrell, the Director General of IUCN, the world's leading scientific authority on species conservation, said the new listing highlights the fragility of nature's wonders, such as the unique spectacle of monarch butterflies migrating across thousands of kilometers, a reference to the insect's remarkable biannual journey across North America. To preserve the rich diversity of nature, we need effective, fairly governed, protected, and conserved areas alongside decisive action to tackle climate change and restore ecosystems, Oberell added. In turn, conserving biodiversity supports communities by providing essential services such as food, water, and sustainable jobs. The population of monarch butterflies in North America has been falling rapidly in recent years, a decline largely unabated by government action to protect the imperiled insects or to fight the climate crisis that is pushing them to the brink of extinction. Echoing recent research attributing the monarch butterfly's decline to the climate emergency, IUCN notes that climate change has significantly impacted the migratory monarch butterfly and is a fast-growing threat. Drought limits the growth of milkweed and increases the frequency of catastrophic wildfires. Temperature extremes trigger earlier migrants before milkweed is available, while severe weather has killed millions of butterflies. The Western population is at greatest risk of extinction, having declined by an estimated 99.9% from as many as 10 million to 1,914 butterflies between 1980s and 2021, the organization observed. The larger eastern population also shrunk by 84% from 1996 to 2014. Concern remains as to whether enough butterflies survive to maintain the populations and prevent extinction. Additionally, IUCN stressed that legal and illegal logging and deforestation to make space for agriculture and urban development have also destroyed substantial areas of the butterfly's winter shelter in Mexico and California. While pesticides and herbicides used in intensive agriculture across the range kill butterflies and milkweed and host plant that the larvae of the monarch butterfly feed on. Anna Walker, a member of IUCN SSC Butterfly and Moth Specialist Group, said recently that while it is difficult to watch monarch butterflies and their extraordinary migration teeter on the edge of collapse, there are signs of hope. So many people and organizations have come together to try and protect this butterfly and its habitats, said Walker, who spearheaded the monarch butterfly assessment, adding, from planting native milkweed and reducing pesticide use to supporting the protection of overwintering sites and contributing to community science, we all have to play a role in making sure this iconic insect makes a full recovery.
Insight. Good afternoon and welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing China-Iran relations in a conversation with Ambassador Chang Kuo. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
In March of 2021, Iran and China signed the 25-year strategic agreement following a process which began with Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to Iran in 2016 and his meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. A strategic alliance of the two ancient civilizations of East and West Asia, who were dominated by foreign imperial powers in the 19th century and who were able to liberate themselves in the mid and late 20th century in two massive popular revolutions. Beyond the bilateral dimensions, this strategic agreement sent shockwaves throughout Western capitals, who had been dreaming of bringing Iran back into the Western strategic sphere of influence after the Islamic Revolution, through an imposed war in the 1980s, and through political destabilization campaigns, immoral economic wars, and full-spectrum maximum pressure sanctions, which were recently determined to be illegal under international law by the United Nations Special Rapporteur, who was tasked to investigate their legality and impact on human rights. Future historians might look at the history of the 20th century and conclude that besides the two world wars that shook the world, the two revolutions of China and Iran, which liberated these ancient lands, reawakened these ancient pillars of human civilization, and established the People's Republic and the Islamic Republic, respectively, are among the most significant events of the 20th century, with a very significant impact on global affairs in the 21st century and beyond. The rise of Asia, Eurasian integration, and the strategic alignment of China, Iran, and Russia spell the eventual end of US global hegemony and the beginning of the post-American world. The whole world is already benefiting from the moral wisdom of these two ancient civilizations' increased presence and prominence in global affairs, foreshadowing a future global system stressing mutual cooperation and peace over the crude, racist, imperialistic mindset of historically, relatively, and recently civilized tribes from a small peninsula on the western end of Asia, which were able to dominate global affairs for a few centuries through mass murder, slavery, and theft of resources on a global scale.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for joining us on Insight. Also, thank you for hosting us. We are at your residence in the garden, in this lovely garden. I hope that we can have a lovely conversation about various subjects. So it's interesting, Mr. Ambassador. I think we are now concluding that 1979 is a very important year. We have the reforms under Deng Xiaoping, and then we have the Islamic Revolution. So these future historians that we were talking about, maybe they will look at the year 1979 and realize this is when the world had a very important change of events. Before we get to Iran-China relations, I know I've been saying it a lot, but there's still a couple questions and a couple issues I want to talk about in terms of more, if you want to call it, global strategy, strategic issues, because we covered a little bit of history. Many experts, probably I would say there's a consensus even among experts, both in the West and in the East, that you know the 21st century is going to be the Asian century. It's already started. It's a lot of things are becoming clear. These nations that we talked about, Iran, China, India, East, Southeast Asia, a lot of things have been happening. It started in the 20th century, but the 21st century, many people are saying, is going to be the Asian century. And we were talking about this before our conversation, that this is actually the way that human history was actually, this is the normal way that human history was, that the center of production and civilization, if you look at the long history of human civilization, has mainly been based in Asia. And what we experienced in the last couple hundred years was maybe a little bit of an anomaly historically. There are some people, of course, who are not happy about this. And they are saying that, well, you know, if China becomes the leading nation in the world in terms of economy and in terms of power and all those other things, it's not going to be any different than the Americans, whatever the Americans are doing now. It's going to be the hegemon. It's going to be the same issue. At least with the Americans, there are things that we can talk to them about, like, you know, their liberal tradition. But no, China is not going to be like this. So if you could please explain to us, if we accept that there's going to be this transformation, if we're going to be entering into the Asian century, and that China is going to be probably the most dominant country in terms of economics and maybe even military and military power, is it going to be different than the Americans, or is it going to be just the same thing for us who are not either America or China?
It is a very interesting and good question, because we all live in Asia. China is in the east part of Asia and Iran on the west part. We could see that there are many countries with great civilizations and long histories in this region, like India and Iraq. I used to work in Iraq for some time. Iraq in the past was a great country. We should say that Asia should be the Asia of our own. Its affairs should be decided by its nation. At the time being, the majority of emerging markets and the majority of developing countries are located in Asia. I suppose we can make our own contributions to the world and its economic development. Because in the past, we could say Asian civilization was the great part and the major part of the global humankind civilization. At the time being, some countries are trying the so-called Indo-Pacific strategy. They are trying to start conflict among Asian countries. We are strongly against this idea. You just asked about China's role and play when it becomes a great power in the world. Would China's actions be different from the U.S.? I should emphasize that Chairman Mao clearly promised that China will never seek hegemony. Deng Xiaoping said the same thing, and President Xi also said clearly and emphasized clearly that China will never seek hegemony. We will never seek the so-called sphere of influence. We will never seek unrest, and I think this is a solemn promise and a clear answer to the world. I remember that the king of the French Empire, Napoleon, used to say that China is a lion. Once it is awake, it will be scary. It will be very scary for the world. But Chairman Mao said that, yes, China is a lion, but we will be awake in the future. We will be certainly awake in the future, but we are a peaceful and lovely lion. We can be the contributor to the global peace and global development. We are devoted to give hands to all developing countries. We want to become united, and we can strengthen our collaboration to promote the multipolarization of the world, to promote the world's economic globalization.
Very nice. Mr. Ambassador, you know, I mentioned this also when we had our conversation with the Ambassador of Russia. The late Zbigniew Brzezinski, the strategist, the American strategist, in his final book, he talked about that the nightmare scenario, the most dangerous scenario for the Americans, is if China, Russia, and Iran have an alliance, have a strategic alliance. So, you know, there's an expression in English language, they say, you know, the person is spinning in their grave. The person is having a difficult time when they're in their grave. Do you think now that we have come to this point in world history where Mr. Brzezinski's worst case scenario is coming to be true? Iran, China, and Russia are entering a strategic alliance. We will talk about the 25-year strategic alliance between China and Iran. Do you think that we are entering into the scenario that Brzezinski was talking about in the late 20th century, where we're entering the post-American world order, and it is actually being done by this triple alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. If you could please give your analysis of this for us.
Now, you studied international relations, and I am a diplomat. Now, the predictions of Brzezinski are at our hands. So I should say that the Cold War has come to the end. But unfortunately, the brains of some people and their mentality have stayed in the same place, in the era of Cold War, and have remained like before. They put forward some concepts, like the conflicts between civilizations. They start confrontations between countries. Perhaps you have noticed that Secretary Blinken of the U.S. State Department some time ago announced the American approach regarding China. Of course, he has announced similar approaches towards Iran and Russia. They use a lot of different words to define their approaches towards us, like competition, like investment, and like alliances. For Iran, they use the tool of sanctions. They're trying to suppress Iran. And for Russia, they are now using sanctions as well. They use NATO at the same time. They are trying to build a siege in Europe against Russia. So I could say that their mentality is much different than ours. It is against global security. Our ideas are different. China, Russia, and Iran, we are independent countries. We have good collaboration in different scenarios and different organizations. Like Iran, for example, is about to become the formal member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And not long ago, Iran was invited to join the BRICS Plus activities. So we are strengthening our cooperation from the perspective of development and security. We are not trying to build a so-called strategic alliance like NATO. We are not trying to make new Cold Wars. We are not trying to confront other countries. So as I said before, China will never seek hegemony. We will never make military alliances with other countries. But actually, for the time being, there are some countries which are making military alliances, especially in the neighboring countries of China. We are strongly against these actions. China, Iran, and Russia have emerging markets. We're the most important developing countries. We should encourage more developing countries to join us. We should work together to fight against unilateralism, to fight power politics and hegemony. We are always against U.S. sanctions against Iran. We're also not supportive of the U.S. to transport large amounts of weapons to Ukraine in order to prolong this Ukraine crisis. For the Ukraine crisis, we always encourage political and diplomatic ways. We should encourage negotiations to address these problems.
Well, it's interesting, Mr. Ambassador, because, you know, it's what we see the Americans doing today in 2022 is exactly the policy that the British were doing 100 years before that, which is they don't want a united Eurasia. They don't want a strong, united, powerful countries in Eurasia like China, like Russia, like Iran, so that they can control Eurasia, because in their strategic thinking, this is not some sort of guess from us. This is in their own books, Halford Mackinder, Alfred Mahan, those strategists in the 19th century, late 19th century, early 20th century, talking about that the goal, the strategic goal, is to prevent prevent Eurasia to become powerful, and for Anglo-America to control the world, they have to control Eurasia. So this is why we see the Ukraine, they're pressuring Russia with Ukraine, they are creating security issues as it relates to Taiwan and China's sovereignty and its own region there. You mentioned Quad. You didn't mention it. You indicated the issue of Quad and the things they're doing with Japan and India. And, of course, in West Asia, we have these constant securitization as it relates to Iran, Israel, other countries. Of course, you know, the joke is, in international relations, there's a joke that we say among the international relations scholars. We say that in the Cold War between the Soviet Union and America, China was the winner. So this is in terms of what you're talking about. So, Mr. Ambassador, I want to now go finally to the issue of Iran-China relations. We had the very, very important, significant signature of the 25-year strategic agreement between China and Iran in the previous administration, which was a surprise for some people because, of course, that administration was famous for trying to come to an agreement with the West. But actually, we explained in our conversation with Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian that these issues are strategic issues in Iran. These are not related to one administration to the other. And this issue of trying to get to a strategic agreement with China has been a long process. This was not something that just recently happened. This has been going on for many years, and it was concluded at that time. And I would argue that this was not simply a bilateral agreement between two countries, which was, of course, important for both countries, but it had a global significance. It was a signal to the world. We saw that immediately the West had reactions to it as it relates to, for example, the negotiations about this JCPOA. It was a signal for the rest of the world. And because it is so sensitive and because it is so important, of course, those who don't like this strategic alliance to happen, of course, have a very strong propaganda war against it, a very strong propaganda campaign against it. As you know, Iran has historically was dominated by the British and then the Americans before the revolution. So we still have many of the people that are connected to that time and are used for this purpose in Iran. And so immediately when this strategic agreement happened, there was, you know, things like, well, this is just China getting cheap oil from Iran, and it's going to just dump low-quality products into the Iranian market. It's going to ruin Iranian manufacturing. This is all in favor of China. Iran has sold itself to China. Of course, those who are within this process, who are part of the political process, know that this is not true. But for the general public, for those who are not familiar with the details of what's going on, what is it? What are the important aspects of this strategic agreement? Is it really just about China getting cheap oil for 25 years and giving Iran, you know, cheap manufactured products, or is there more to this? If you could please explain from the Chinese perspective, what is it that made China decide to enter into a long-term agreement with Iran?
Before answering your question about China and Iran relations, I would like to say a few more words about multilateralism. July 3rd is the 25th anniversary of Hong Kong's return to China. Before that, it was under colonialist rule of Britain. There was no democracy back then. But now, Hong Kong people can attend elections and choose the head of their government through elections. They can choose their own legislations. But presently, some countries with the thought of colonialism still use Hong Kong as an excuse to attack China. They still have the Cold War mentality. They are still seeking hegemony and power politics. You just mentioned the Taiwan issue and the Ukraine crisis. I should emphasize that Taiwan's question is totally different from the Ukraine crisis. Ukraine is an independent country, but Taiwan historically belongs to China. So the issue of China is totally an issue of Chinese internal affairs. But some countries, they are making nonsense about this issue. They proclaim that the mainland China is making military threats against Taiwan. It is totally nonsense. People in Taiwan are our brothers and sisters. We will never harm them, but we are strongly against the independence of Taiwan. We will never allow foreign countries to intervene in this issue. If the situation becomes like that, we will have the final say on how to solve the Taiwan issue. Chinese people will never agree and say a big no to foreign countries intervening. And in terms of China-Iran relations, let's just have a quick flashback about this question. China is in the East and Iran is in the West of Asia. Our friendly cooperation can go back to 2,000 years ago. Last year was depicted as the anniversary of the establishment of our diplomatic ties between China and Iran. During these 50 years of cooperation in the fields of politics, economy, and culture, we were able to keep it active. In the year 2016, President Xi paid an important visit to Tehran, and back then we decided to enhance our relations to comprehensive strategic partnership. And during President Xi's visit to Tehran, the two states also issued a joint statement. in this statement, there is a specific item which says China and Iran are ready to discuss long-term cooperation plans. So after that, Iran actually gave us a draft of this long-term cooperation. And after discussions of many years, last year, Foreign Minister Wang Yi visited Tehran as well. And during that visit, China and Iran decided to sign this collaboration plan, which includes collaboration in various areas, in all areas, including politics, economy, culture, and security. In January and March, Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian paid a visit to China, and we jointly announced the implementation of this plan. We should discuss in the short term what should we do and what can be done about China-Iran collaboration. I think this kind of collaboration can be beneficial both to China and to Iran. You just mentioned some announcements about this cooperation plan, about China buying oil from Iran at a low price, and then China dumping a cheap goose into the Iranian market. I saw all such statements in the media, but I should say that this collaboration must be beneficial for both countries. China, for many years, has kept his position as the biggest partner of Iran. How could this happen? In all these years, America's strong sanctions are still there, but we are not afraid of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. government tried to reduce Iran's oil export to zero, but we are strongly against this policy. I could say that not only China is buying oil from Iran, other countries are afraid of buying oil from Iran. We tried a lot to preserve our relations with Iran. This cooperation is beneficial to both of us. Of course, Chinese companies and people are benefiting too. We need to work together to make this cake bigger and bigger. But the 25-year cooperation plan, it is not against any of the signatories. Iran is also discussing long-term cooperation with Russia and Venezuela. We're independent countries. I would like to add a few points about the Belt and Road Initiative and the Iranian nuclear issue. About the Belt and Road Initiative, I should say that Iran is an important part of this initiative. This initiative is put forward by President Xi Jinping. Iran was an important hub in the ancient Silk Road. I traveled to the city of Tabriz. I saw a lot of relics there from the ancient Silk Road. So I believe that Iran can play a key role in this initiative. About the Iranian nuclear issue, I should say that in the last several months, this issue has come to an impasse. Today, I noticed that Deputy Foreign Minister Bagheri traveled to Doha to restart negotiations. China has been a constructive part during these negotiations. We do not agree about some parties' attempts to make this issue more complicated. Perhaps you have noticed that some countries promoted Iran-related resolution to the IAEA, but of course, we voted against it. We are against politicizing this issue. The Iranian nuclear issue has come to an important junction. Parties of the nuclear deal should solve the problems through negotiations, and we should try to promote this negotiation and try to get past the results of this resolution. Because for the current Iranian nuclear issue, I think it is clear what is wrong and what is right. The U.S. unilateral acts against Iran and its added sanctions are the root cause of this current impasse in the negotiations. So we urge the U.S. to correct its mistakes and answer Iran's reasonable request and to take the first step and come back to the deal.
Mr. Ambassador, we've unfortunately come to the end of our time. Thank you once again for hosting us. If there's anything you want to still mention that was not mentioned, please, you have a few minutes, and then we can end our conversation.
Well, I am very happy to have this very important interview with you. I wish we could prolong it. There are still many issues that we haven't talked on yet. I wish in the future we will have more opportunities like this. China and Iran are true and good friends, especially after the COVID-19 pandemic. We can help each other. We never forget that Iran was the first country which expressed its support to China when the pandemic started in China. And after the pandemic started in Iran, China supplied the most number of vaccines to Iran. So please convey my message to the Iranian public that I truly hope that Iran and China relations can continue under the guidance of Iran's leadership and the support of our people.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you.
So what insight can we gain from our conversation with Ambassador Chang? China's initial focus on development in its global relations has been enhanced by the addition of security as a pillar in these global relations in recent years. This is after everyone in the world experienced nearly 30 years of global war, mass killings, and economic sanctions and extortion by the exceptional nation and so-called